Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to our Action Research Podcast, created by the HEAR Lab team at the University of Houston. The HEAR Lab is the hub for engaged action research, and the mission of the lab is to build the capacity of scholars to create and disseminate collaborative, accessible, anti-racist research that centers community and fuels social change. Through hosting different activities such as walk and learns, webinars, or disseminating one-page research briefs, the team hopes to amplify research beyond articles and connect scholars to one another. Research should be done to create an impact, and by hosting this podcast, the hope is to have more awareness around anti-racist research approaches, as well as seeing how research goes beyond articles to connect to practice and policy. Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to our Action Research Podcast, created by the HEAR Lab team at the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work. We're excited to begin this series of episodes focused on doctoral student dissertations. Today, we welcome Dr. Caitlin Mitelka. She is a recent PhD graduate from the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work and is a licensed social worker in Texas. She has a bachelor's degree from NYU and a master's degree in social work from UT Austin. Caitlin's research focuses on positive youth development in diverse school settings. So without further ado, Caitlin, I would love to hear about your dissertation. If you could tell us a little bit about what it was about.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me here. I'm really happy to share and to be chatting with
you about this. The HEAR Lab is a hub for engaged action research.
So my dissertation was
about the mission of the lab is to build the capacity of scholars to create and disseminate collaborative, accessible, anti-racist research that centers community and fuels social change.
So I was
hosting different activities such as walk and learns, webinars, and disseminating one-page research briefs,
as well as
the HEAR Lab team hopes to amplify research beyond articles and connect scholars to one another.
I was really looking
research
at
should be done to create an impact, and by hosting this podcast, the hope is to have more awareness around anti-racist research approaches, as well as seeing how research goes beyond articles to connect practice to policy. As a team, we aim to redefine how research is shared.
Yeah, great question. Actually, yes.
Specifically?
For a few different reasons. So one is I was a school social worker before. I did mental health therapy in schools. And something that I really noticed is I had a lot of young people that really had a lot of symptoms of depression, symptoms of anxiety, not necessarily diagnosable mental health disorders, but definitely something where they needed some more active
engagement from a higher level than just the universal classroom level.
So that was something that got me interested in prevention as well as what can we do to prevent these types of symptoms that we know are so common, especially since COVID. Symptoms of depression. So we look forward to connecting with listeners by encouraging reflection and conversation. Stay in touch or share your thoughts by tagging us on Twitter at GCSW HEAR Lab. I was really interested
today,
in early adolescence.
We welcome
I know from
Dr.
my personal
Caitlin
experience,
Mitelka.
Not just professional,
Caitlin, I totally messed
that
up your
that was
last
a really
name.
Difficult time for me. And that if I had had
Mitelka?
Some type of explicit instruction around coping skills or how to navigate relationships,
Mitelka.
Conflict
okay.
resolution, things like that. I really
today,
felt like
we
I would have benefited
Dr. Caitlin
from that.
Mitelka.
So that was really
nope,
something that
I
got me interested in middle school specifically.
Say it again.
As well as when I engaged and looked more in the literature
no.
and just realized what an understudied
okay.
time of development that is, yet so critical.
Well, thanks for being brave enough and vulnerable to share with us that this isn't necessarily just all about the research, but also your personal experience and how both of those have shaped your inspiration to do this research out in the field. So as you talk a little bit about your dissertation, I know you just told us a little bit about it. Can you tell us about how you set up your dissertation and if there is any intentional anti-racist
sure.
and social justice
Actually,
lenses
yes, in,
that you considered while you set it up?
In discussing the social justice lens or anti-racist focus in this dissertation, that was definitely something I already had my topic of interest when I came into the PhD program, really interested in preventive intervention programs and models in schools. But what I really noticed in the literature was a gap. So much of the literature really used primarily white samples of young people to study these things. And so one particular piece, something that was really critical and important to me when I set the dissertation up, was that I really wanted a diverse, racially and ethnically diverse students in within the sample. So that was just definitely something that I was looking to do. And then as I went further through the PhD program, I actually ended up doing a secondary data analysis with data that I actually had access to through my research internship. And so it was they were looking at preventive interventions in middle schools, and it's actually a randomized controlled trial, but they have a really diverse sample of over 1,200 students in the control schools, which is what I actually ended up looking at for my study specifically. But I really thought that because I want to focus on how to inform and develop equitable preventive interventions, since, like I mentioned, so much of that is based on homogeneous samples, that was really something I was looking for. And so once I met, you know, Dr. Temple and worked with the Center for Violence Prevention there at UTMB Health, I became really interested in, you know, the type of work they were doing, as well as the diversity of the students that they were working with.
And so you talk about Dr. Temple and UTMB. Could you give me a little bit more information? You said you did your research internship there. Give me that background.
Yeah,
actually,
of how you
I
was really lucky
to
have connected
really
with them
like.
Prior to entering into the doctoral program. So I was working for school district in Galveston on a grant-based funding that they had received from BridgeUp at Menninger, and which is a huge psychiatric hospital in Houston. And so they were really interested in this kind of exact thing. How do we integrate social emotional learning in the classrooms and enhance mental health supports on school campuses? And Dr. Temple was, I think that project is over, the principal investigator of that. And so it's connected to the school district. And then also because of that, you know, I had met him and actually he had told me about that position. So there were a lot of connections prior to the doctoral program. And so I worked for the school district, continued my relationship with the Center for Violence Prevention through that capacity, and then really just kept working with them through the doctoral program. The way the GCSW's program works is there is a required research internship as a part of it. And so at the end of the second year, and I did my research internship with them because I was already working with them, continuing to work on that school district data, and actually continued to work on that same data and that same project.
Fantastic. And I know that a lot of our listeners want to hear about this dissertation process. And so that's why I'm trying to really see and hear your process as an individual. And I know this wasn't part of the other question, so I appreciate you going out of what we had talked about earlier in terms of how you set up your dissertation. So to bring it back, you talk about you came into this PhD with experience, with being connected to this research, and you were set up primarily with a project that you had already been a part of. Now, if you were to think about your research and how you went about it, were there any considerations for timelines?
Okay, yeah.
Or
so
your writing
basically,
process
once
for
I identified my data set and everything fit well, I worked on my research questions and then spent quite a long time developing my dissertation proposal to fit in with what I, of course, was interested in, as well as what was available in the data and based on the number of student data that they had captured, which for me was quite a lot. I had over 1,200 young people in my sample. So I would say I spent a long time to write the proposal. And then I think this is really individual. I think some of my big takeaways from that are to know yourself and how you work. Definitely I'm the kind of person that does like much better if I have deadlines, even if they weren't real, you know, they were just deadlines that I created with my dissertation chair, kind of internal deadlines. That was very helpful for me to move forward with the process. Just having that kind of accountability, someone, you know, looking to read and scheduling time to read, you know, different chapters at different times. That was very helpful to me, as well as just trying to write a few times a week. Whether it be that through the data analyses or in the writing, the proposal or the final dissertation, in those different stages, I really tried to be consistent with doing the work so that I didn't have to spend a lot of time re-reviewing materials every time and figuring out where I was. So more so than any hard and fast rules for timeline, I think some of my main recommendations are, you know, do what works with your individual schedule, when you see yourself graduating, how much time, you know, that kind of thing. But then also just, I think one of my big recommendations is also to keep logs. I found it very helpful to have just a running document of notes, both when I was writing and when I was working on the statistics, because I would tell myself, okay, this is what I did in this work session. This is some of the things that were interesting or that I found. Nothing like, you know, very, very informal. And then I would tell myself, this is what you need to do next. And so when I came back and opened the document the next day, I'd start a new date and I'd look and see, okay, what is it that I did? What was it that I wanted, you know, to focus on this time that I was working? That overall was super helpful for me. So I know that's not timeline per se, but I think it definitely helped me stay on a timeline, which can be very difficult, in my opinion, when you're in the dissertation writing process.
And it's exciting to hear your process, right? I don't think any dissertation is the same, whether it's you're doing a research project, whether you're doing a secondary data analysis. I think all of them are very unique and to each person. So I appreciate you sharing your tips and tricks. As you reflect on your process, is there something you wish you knew looking back?
Yes, I think that one of the biggest things I can say, this is honestly applies to my everyday life, but is that everything does not have to be perfect. I was really focused on, So I was really focused on
perfecting
the dissertation proposal and everything being in place. And I've looked through every piece of literature and read everything. And, you know, I incorporated everything I knew. And I mean, not, you know, within reason, of course. But at the same time, I think that that isn't necessary. And sometimes it's just overly time consuming. Frankly, you will make changes. It's very likely you will make changes when you write the final dissertation based on what data you collect, what you find, what you're able, you know, for me, I wasn't able to run some of the analyses that I had originally planned and thought. My sample just didn't work out in the way that I thought once I really got into how many students came from each school, which was really important in the type of statistics that I did for my dissertation. So I had to change things. So all of this focus on the proposal being perfect, you know, just wasn't necessary. And even honestly, with the dissertation itself, it just doesn't have to be absolutely perfect. The point is to show that you can complete a comprehensive project from start to finish. So I just think that it doesn't have to be perfect. And there are some things that you can let go with your dissertation. For a lot of us, you know, we'll continue to do research in the future. And so you can do some of the things that you maybe hoped you would do, or you had a bigger idea in mind for the dissertation. But frankly, it definitely is true when they say, you know, the best dissertation is a done dissertation. Not to say it shouldn't be good and it shouldn't be some like great quality of work that you really put time and effort and energy into developing just the work. But I also think a big part of it is developing yourself too as a researcher and scholar. And so really it doesn't have to be perfect.
I love hearing that. And it's refreshing, especially as someone who is in their dissertation phase as well. So you talk about preparing and putting the first couple chapters together. I want to really segment into how did you then prepare to defend your dissertation?
For sure, once I wrote the final draft of my dissertation, so completed all my data analysis, you know, wrote up the last two chapters, my results and discussion chapter, I felt like I had a really solid draft at that point, and I sent it to my chair, who then read and gave me feedback on it, which I then incorporated, sent the final version out to the committee. I know all this sounds like, oh, these are just different steps, but for me, this was all part of how I prepared for that final day where I stood up and, you know, talked about my project. But basically I got any other feedback from my committee, incorporated that, and then used it to create a final draft as well as a PowerPoint that kind of succinctly summarized what I had found, what I did for the dissertation. So for me, the real crux of the preparation for the defense was, you know, practicing the PowerPoint. I practiced in front of my dissertation chair, who gave me a lot of feedback on how to improve it, things that I focused too much detail on that were unnecessary, things that I didn't explain or talk enough about. So getting that kind of feedback from the chair, as well as family members and my husband, I definitely practiced it in front of them a bunch of times and, you know, learned where I was, you know, where the language needed to change so that, you know, those in the audience who were not necessarily from a research background would understand what was going on. So really it was about practicing it, making sure I understood the content on the slides. I ran a lot of models as a part of my dissertation project. So just making sure I knew where I was in the PowerPoint and didn't get too confused was definitely important. So, and then I think what everybody, you know, often focuses on is the questions, preparing for that part of the defense. So for me, I wrote out a list of questions that I thought each member of my committee would ask me about, or anyone else, just things that I thought might be weaker in the project or questions that I had thought myself about certain decisions I had made, for example. And then basically I used the feedback that my chair and my committee members gave me, as well as my knowledge of them, to write these questions. And then I practiced answering them several different times. But to be transparent, I think that for me, making sure the PowerPoint was set that I really felt comfortable throughout that part of the presentation ultimately helped me with any questions that I got. I feel like that was probably what I spent the least amount of time on, but yet in the middle of the defense, I felt perfectly prepared to answer them.
And before you tell us exactly what you found or your results, I ask about community and how you disseminate the results to the community that it serves. So what are your thoughts, or what is your process?
So I am still working through that process.
Or where are you in
that process? A couple different pieces. I mean, obviously, you know, working on wanting to present and write papers on this, but in order to actually reach the community that I envision this research being helpful for, I am working to create a one-page research summary so I can easily disseminate that online or on social media channels. And then I'm also working on a specific policy brief based on these findings. I hope, because I'm going to continue working with Dr. Temple and the Center for Violence Prevention, I also hope to present my results to members from the school communities from which these data were drawn. So they do continue to work with those school districts. And so my hope is that my research can also be incorporated into their reports as well, related to their findings. Of course, for the original study that was done, the parent study, and then, you know, my secondary data findings as well. And then, you know, I think things like coming on this dissertation series to talk about it, I mean, it's all part of what I also see being, you know, I know that's not the focus of this, but just little pieces as well, trying to get some types of media exposure, things like that. Those are my hopes. I definitely am still working on that aspect. I think that's definitely a hard piece to accomplish as a scholar, when so much of the so much of what we're pushed to do is publish in academic settings, journals, do conference presentations, but just, you know, we know that that's not necessarily reaching the people that we hope it is. So definitely still working through how to best reach out to schools. Yeah.
And pushing that, right? Appreciate you naming that we've been pushed to write papers or present, and it doesn't necessarily serve the community that the research is focused on. So wanting to try these extra different ways, whether it's writing that one pager or a policy brief, wanting to present to the school communities, that's the impact of the research that you've created. So I look forward to following your journey as you talk about your research, as you share your research.
So to wrap it all up, I would love to hear what you found. What were your results? And what are some action steps that people can take?
So I was really excited when I ran all my statistics and data analysis for my project to find some support for some of the hypotheses that I had. More specifically, as I talked about, I was interested in this idea of these two-way or reciprocal relationships that happen between coping style and symptoms of depression and anxiety. And so I did find support for some of those two-way relationships existing in middle school youth. So I found that, for example, active coping, so planning skills, organization, essentially active ways of dealing with stressors, is related to depressive symptoms. So, for example, if you're using more active coping skills in seventh grade, that was related to having lower symptoms of depression in eighth grade. Whereas the reverse was also true. So if you had more symptoms of depression in seventh grade, in eighth grade, you were tending to use less active coping skills. I also found that there was this two-way relationship between avoidant coping and anxiety symptoms that worked similarly. I thought one of my most interesting findings was that more avoidant copings in seventh grade was related to higher anxiety in eighth grade, and those relationships were also flipped. So other relationships I looked at were often significant in one way, from seventh to eighth, but those were the two that existed with these two-way relationships. Of particular interest is a lot of these relationships in my study were affected by gender. So male and female early adolescent students had differing relations between coping style and symptoms of depression and anxiety. I had hoped to do more analyses that looked at these, different types of subgroups of young people, but I was able to run the data analysis separately for male and female students. And yeah, what I found was that one size does not appear to fit all when we're talking about coping. Male and female students weren't necessarily having the same relationships between these variables. And so that was just something that was also really, really interesting. And I also think important for developing, further equitable interventions that are going to impact all of the young people that we hope to impact, not just the few that we, got data on and found significant results for or something like that. And then in terms of action research, action steps, I really hope that people will hear about this research and just begin to advocate for the importance of explicitly teaching these types of skills to young people in the classrooms, in school settings, beyond as well. My focus is schools, but I don't think it should be limited to schools, of course. I know that, and I was touching on this before, most of us just weren't taught how to do these things. How do we have healthy relationships? How do we break up with a romantic partner, for example? These are skills that can be taught to young people. And they, I think if I had learned some of these things, that would have been very helpful for me. I think a lot of us would have benefited from these types of skills because we use them every day in our lives as adults. And I think a lot of us are continuing to work to grow and build those skills too. And so I really hope that people will buy into this concept that we can teach socio-emotional skills to young people. It's not just something that, comes out of the sky and all of a sudden you're wonderful at dealing with people. No, these are things that we learn. And so if we can help young people and equip them with these skills earlier, I think that will really help them manage risks as they move through adolescence. So I just hope that people will continue to advocate and reach out to school administrators and leaders, reach out to school board members about adding these socio-emotional competencies into the curriculum. I think that also state educational boards and federal policymakers, we can push for more funding for these types of programs and models in schools from pre-K all the way through high school.
I'm going to take away a couple things that you're saying. One size does not fit all. I appreciate you saying that. And then I go into what you say of the skills being taught at different times. Whether it's being policymakers, whether it is state board members for schools, these skills can be advocated for and can say, hey, we need to teach this in school. So I appreciate you bringing all that together and really look forward to seeing how your goal to inform and develop equitable preventative interventions in schools occurs over your research journey.
I just wanted to thank you for having me and having this discussion. Always like to take the time to talk about something that I'm so passionate about and hope to continue. I'll be curious to see how the research unfolds as well.
The HEAR Lab team is here to connect with scholars and community to amplify voices in research. We look forward to connecting with listeners through their reflection and conversations. If you see public impact scholarship occurring in your community, tag us. Let us know. Stay in touch or share your thoughts by tagging us on Twitter at #GCSWHEARLab. Rate our show, leave us a review, and subscribe so you can learn about all things HEAR Lab and can cultivate change in research procedures, policy, and impact practice. This is your host, Anil Arora, signing off, living the dream.